This morning we're going to pick back up again in the book of Job, Job chapter 2, if you want to turn there. I was excited that they sent me a text message the other day, said I'm going to get to teach an Old Testament survey class at Coastal, which I was excited about. And they said you have 1 week to put your syllabus and everything together. And so one of the things, in addition to while we're moving the kids and dealing lots of other things, been trying to figure out what do you talk about in a survey of Old Testament class. I am getting a lot of, I can hear me, I don't like to hear me, I don't know how y'all listen to me, I don't like hearing me, anybody else like that, but anyway, so, and I'm trying to put together what's in this survey of Old Testament class. I'm like, I can think of a whole lot of things I would like to put in a survey of the Old Testament class. In fact, I can think of a whole lot of stuff I would like to put in a survey of Old Testament class. Problem with that is, see, this is a class that the college students are taking. Some of them might be generally interested in it. Some of them might want a deep dive. Some of them might want all the details. But in reality, a lot of them are signing up because they see it as the least worst option out of the ones that were presented to them. And as I told the college kids this morning, I said, one thing I don't want to do at the end of this, I don't want to get people to where they hate the Old Testament and say, I am never opening that Bible up again. I am never reading that again. I hate that class. I hate that class. I hate that. So what do you put in it? How long is long enough to do a good job, but brief enough to you know, hold interest and that kind of thing? It's kind of like whenever, how many times have you said today to somebody already the word fine? The word fine. How are you doing today? Fine. How are you? How are you doing today? Fine. I don't know how many of you are doing fine this morning, but if we said you have 5 minutes, you have to tell us about what's going on in your life, you might not use the word fine at all. But that's the expected answer. Why? Because I don't want people to walk away from that saying, I'm never asking them that again. So that's kind of the same idea of what's going on in your life. In Job chapter 2, it is a squished, condensed version. If somebody came up to Job and said, how you doing? He wouldn't have said fine, but he also probably knew better than to tell them everything that's going on in his life, because it's a lot. Kind of fast-forwarding or rewinding, I guess I should say, in the book of Job, we're introduced to him. He's a man of God who walks blamelessly before the Lord. He fears God and turns away from evil. And Job is blessed. He's got the life. He's got it all. He's got the family. Boom. Awesome family. He's got the riches, sheep and camels, and I don't know what, and oxen. And he's got land. He's got servants. He is living the dream, man. He is living the dream. But then we see that there's a divine council. God gets together. The angels are coming in. In that, evidently, the fallen angels also, because Satan comes in. And God says, hey, where you been? And he says, here and there. Which, if you remember, we said that's basically a way of saying, I've been up to no good. And so as he's been looking through, God says, hey, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one else like him. And gives the same description that we read about earlier. He is a man of integrity, absolute, utmost integrity. Day by day, he does what is right. And so then the Satan, the accuser, says, well, yeah, because you blessed him. You quit blessing, he'll quit blessing you. You quit blessing him, he'll quit blessing you. You stop, you just put one little kink in that wrench and it's all going to fall apart. And so on the same day, he comes and finds out that not only did his sheep die, not only did his camels and his oxen and his donkeys die, not only did all of his possessions die, also his children, or not died, but were stolen and taken away, his children died. And so four different messengers all in the same day, this short little period of time, Job went from having it all to having none of it, to having nothing that was left. And so, but at the end of that, Job said, look, I was born with nothing. I'm going to die with nothing. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And so now we get to chapter 2 and we see that the Satan was proven to have been wrong in his assumption that if you take away all of Job's stuff, he's still going to keep right on praising you. And so that's what Job ended up doing. And so now we get to it and we see what happened sometime later. Excuse me. In the beginning of chapter 2 it says, one day the sons of God came again to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. Now, there's a difference there. The sons of God came and Satan came. And maybe there's lots of different reasons why he might be separated out. But he figures prevalently. And so the Lord asked, said, where have you come from? And he gives kind of the same, I'm up to no good. From roaming through the earth, Satan answered, and walking around on it. In other words, very vague, very, I'm not going to give you any incriminating evidence, but I've been out there, I've been doing stuff. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity, who fears God and turns away from evil. He still retains his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason. Now, we hear that, and our hearts skip a beat. It's like God was incited against him, even though Satan incited against him to destroy him for no good reason. And we think, what is the definition? How can God destroy him for no good reason? Is God so capricious? Is he so on a whim, like, okay, I'll destroy him for no good reason? And we listen to that, and we hear that, and we know that God knows all, and we know that God knew what the outcome was going to be. We know that God knows all of this, yet it's hard on our ears to think about God destroying him for no good reason. And so the question becomes, what is good? And how can we say that a perfectly good God who always does what is good and what is right ever do something that would be called destroying and for no good reason? And so that kind of stirs up a little bit of drama. It stirs up a little bit of thought within us. But Satan, he says, well, okay, yeah, he didn't turn away. He still has and maintains his integrity. He still is blameless and upright. He still continually is saying, yep, bless the name of the Lord. I'm sure, yeah, but there's a reason for that. Skin for skin, Satan answered. A man will give up everything he owns in exchange for his life. In other words, he's saying, yes, I see that you did a lot against him, but you didn't go far enough. Because, I mean, he's still got his health, right? Isn't that a proverb that people say now and then? Well, at least I got my health. As long as you have maintained him, you said don't touch him. And so why does he really care about anything else as long as he's got himself? He's still doing all right. But I tell you what, if you will stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, then surely he will curse you to your face. And so Satan says, look, you took a lot from him. You took millions and millions of dollars. Because if you add up, you know, there's over $1 million in sheep, over $1 million in donkeys, $1 million in camels, multi-million dollars worth of assets. Even his own children. He said, look, I know that you took a whole lot away from him. But you didn't touch him. And what does anybody really care as long as they're okay? I mean, so the world is falling down around you. But you're still okay. So Job, you didn't touch Job. So you didn't really give him a fair test. You didn't really give him a fair chance, a really good shakeout here. Stretch out your hand and strike his flesh, and then you'll see his true colors. Then surely he will curse you to his face. When I read this, I think of reach out your hand. I think of it almost a reversal of that creation. Because Michelangelo's painting in the Sistine Chapel, you know, where God and Adam are about to touch fingertips. Like, reach out your hand. Not in creation, not in relationship, but reach out your hand and strike him. And surely he will curse you. Very well, the Lord told Satan. He's in your power. Only spare his life. So Satan left the Lord's presence and infected Job with terrible boils from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of pottery to scrape himself while he sat among the ashes. Now Job, it doesn't say exactly what kind of disease it was. A lot of scholars think it's leprosy. Some think it's elephantitis, which I'm not real familiar with, but it's evidently like your skin turns black and gets hard and crusty. And if you read a couple of chapters, like in Job 7:7, he says that he has sores, and in 7:5, it says, my flesh is clothed with maggots and encrusted with dirt. My skin forms scabs and then oozes. So it's some type of disease that his skin keeps oozing out things on a regular basis. In Job 30:30, he's describing himself, and he said, my skin blackens and flakes off, and my bones burn with fever. So whatever this disease is, We don't know how Job contracted it other than Satan was responsible for it, but it had boils that kept oozing and it changed the color of his skin, and it was a terrible infection. And he was inflicted from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. You see, there was no part of Job that was not afflicted with this. All over his body, he's now tormented by oozing and scabbing and itching and irritated and painful, and he's got sores all over himself. And so when Satan came, we're not sure how he did it. Whenever he stole the camels, there was an invading army that came and stole the camels. Whenever the children died, it was a wind that caused the collapse of the house that killed the kids. We're not sure how or why Job got this disease. We don't even know if this disease has ever existed before or since then. Maybe this was something that Satan conjured up all of his own that was the most painful and serious infection of all time. But whatever it is, he is infected with this from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, head to toe. And so in the pain, and because of that, he takes pottery shards. Most likely, a lot of people think that Job at this time, because it says earlier that he's been mourning and he tears his clothes at the end of chapter 1. And he sits in the dust and the ashes and he covers himself in a time of mourning. A lot of people think that what Job probably did was to go outside the city. Now, thankfully, we have sanitation. I don't know how many of you are on the city sewage. I don't know how many of you have septic tanks. I don't know how many of you live where you have to, whenever you take your dog for a walk, you have to take little baggies. But think about a time whenever they didn't have any of that. There had to be some way to get rid of the excrement of both people and animals and everything. And so they would collect it in like pottery jars, and then they would take it outside to the city to a certain place where they would dump it. And then once a week they would burn it. Burn the refuse. And over time, the dust and ashes would accumulate and the rain would come and it would compact, and it was this place. A lot of people think that this is where Job went. It would not be the first time somebody had gone to one of these sites as a display of public mourning. And so maybe Job is sitting in the burnt dung heap ashes and maybe that's where the infection came from. But as he's sitting there in the midst of this filth, in the midst of these ashes, he is broken and he is mourning for what's going on. And one of the pots, you know how it is, inevitably you go there and it's going to be smelling bad, and maybe somebody's pot broken. And so he reaches over and grabs one of those pot shards, and this burning and itching and this oozing, and he scrapes. Hoping to provide some kind of relief for the torment that he's in. And Job, this broken man who was once the greatest man in all of the East, this greatest man, this man who had it all, this man who had the family, who now has nothing. His children have died. All of his possessions are gone. This man who once used to no doubt be in the pinnacle of health. I mean, everything about him seems to be going good. Now is broken, not only emotionally, but physically. And as he scrapes, everything about the situation screams that this test was hard. Everything about it screams and points to where maybe he should just curse God. In fact, even his wife comes to this conclusion. In verse 9, it says, his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, I don't want to say that the wife was, I've heard people make jokes, I think offhanded and wrong, that Job wishes that his wife was the one taken. I don't think that. I think that he had a good wife. Because Job, everything about him, everything about his household, everything about his situation says that she would have been a woman of integrity too. And even his next comment says that this was contrary to her normal character. But she experienced loss also. She also, as her identity was tied to her husband, that everybody would have been saying, oh, as everybody came to Job and said, you know, you had to be sinning. God really got you because of what you've been doing. Everybody would have thought the same thing about her. Said, yeah, well, you're just getting what you deserve. I knew behind y'all's closed doors y'all weren't as perfect as y'all thought y'all were. And she has lost servants. She has lost the riches. She has lost the identity that she had in that situation also. She lost her children. And as she's grieving and as she's mourning and as she's going through all of this, she comes out and she says what probably a lot of people had, I mean, Job had probably thought of it and had rejected it. It's the very test that the question on the test was, will you continue in your integrity or B, will you curse God and die? Job had probably thought of that situation also, but he rejected it. And he says in verse 10, he says, you speak as a foolish woman speaks. See, it is probably contrary to how she would normally speak. This is not her normal disposition, how she would normally speak, yet this is what she's coming to this situation. And he said, should we accept only good from God and not adversity? Adversity? Throughout all of this, Job did not sin in what he said. See, Job said, should we accept only good from God and not adversity? Earlier it was said, you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason. And here Job is saying, look, should we're receiving adversity from God, but should we not accept the adversity as well as the good? You've probably heard this description before, that good is simply the absence, or that evil is simply the absence of good. You've probably heard it said before, it's kind of like there's no such thing as darkness, there's only the absence of light. There's no such thing as cold, there's only the absence of heat. Like there's no way to define what cold is except, I mean, you can do like this, and we know what cold is, but technically speaking, cold is the absence of heat. Darkness is simply, you can't create darkness. The only way to create darkness is to remove all light. So it's the absence of light that is darkness. You could also say a similar thing with death. Death is simply the absence of life. How do you check to see if someone has died? You check to see if there is an absence of breath, an absence of pulse. Death is the absence of life. And so it is with evil, it is the absence of good. That goes back to the apologetic type question of how can a good God, how could God have not created evil? And it's not that God created something new in evil. It's simply the rejection or the absence of the good that God created. And so Job here, I mean, I'm not saying that he's giving a full theological treatise, but whenever he says, how can we accept good from God and not adversity, in reality, he might could have phrased it, how can we take it whenever God keeps pouring out what we think is good, but if God quits pouring out good, are we going to certainly turn cheek? If God says, I'm like on the, for instance, for if you're giving your kids a popsicle every day, maybe you're training them to do something, potty training them. Hey, you went in the potty. Yay. Here, have a sticker, or here, have a cookie, have a brownie. And then the first time that they say, hey, I went in the potty, and you say, good job. And they say, where's my cookie? And you don't give them the cookie. Does that mean that they turn face and all of a sudden it's not worth it anymore? No, that's not how that works. but Job saying, how can we accept good from God and not adversity? You see, the reality of it was, it felt like an adversity. It felt like a destroying. It felt like God actively opposing and against them. It's not that God, in his wife's view, in a lot of people's view, it's not that God simply withheld extra good. Oh, it's been 5 years since I've added any more sheep. I should be up to 1,000 sheep. I should be up to 10,000 sheep by now. It's not that God quit expanding and explaining and compounding their interest. It's that now there was something removed, that absence of that good that was there before. Where God once was giving, 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 all of a sudden the continual giving wasn't there. It felt like an adversity. It felt like a destruction. It felt like an evil. But Job said, no, we will not only accept good and not adversity. He maintained his integrity. In all this, he did not sin in what it is that he said. See, we can respond to things in a lot of different ways. The fact that some bad came upon their life, he could respond positively or negatively. We're all going to have, the Lord causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. We're all going to have good days. We're all going to have bad days. That's just the reality of what it is. But how do we respond in the midst of all that? I think y'all know we moved Kendall and Caleb into college this past week. And we respond very differently. in different situations. We can cry. Gabby has regressed. She's started throwing temper tantrums. She just keeps going to picture and saying, "I love her." Talking about Kendall, Bo has evidently, we never thought he was a smart dog, but he seems to have forgotten where his feed bowl is. He's revolting by he's quit eating, which, let's be real, he could stand to lose a few pounds. But I'm going through it too. It's not just a them situation. I thought, well, at least now at 8:30 when the kids go to bed, I can do stuff. Do you know what I do at 8:30 now? I go to bed. I thought, I'm going to have so much stuff to do, but like, I just don't feel like it, but I don't know why. And I know it's a result of, it's not a permanent thing, but it's a result. It's a way of grieving, if you will. And so whenever we encounter these situations, we're going to have an opportunity to respond positively, respond negatively. We're going to have emotions that come into it that are going to determine what it is we do. And for Job, he's had a whole lot compound. He's had a whole lot. He doesn't have a "how are you doing fine" kind of moment. Everybody can look at him and tell he's not doing fine. It's not "how are you doing? Well, I've had better days." He could, it's hard to find or identify a worse day that anybody could have, a worse week, a worse period of time than anybody could have. But yet, in the midst of it all, he said, "Look, it's not a good day. But I know that God is still in control. So even though I don't like what he's doing in my life right now, it's not a reason to curse him. It's not a reason to turn my back on the God who's walked with me through it all. It's a God that is still worthy of praise, and he still maintained his integrity. He still was a man that kept praising God. He said, this is a foolish speak to think of anything, of any situation that could turn me away from my Lord. We get to that next little section there, which is kind of setting up the rest of the chapter, but we look and we see. Now, Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all this activity that had happened to him. Each of them came from his home. Now, these different cities and these names are alluded to differently in the Bible. Some of them are definitely like from Edom. In fact, the Temanite, that's used synonymously with Edom in different parts of the Bible. Even in Jeremiah 49:7, it says that there is no more wisdom in Teman. See, Edom and Edom and this surrounding area where Job was from, it was known for being wise people, for people speaking with wisdom. And then God said that the wisdom was going to cease. So as Job's three friends come, they're probably wise friends. They're probably experienced friends. They're probably people that you can usually count on for good counsel. But even beyond that, they are Job's friends. Whenever something bad happens, do you run away from the bad things that happen? Or do you run to them? Now, it doesn't say how long this took place. And if you look in different parts of Job, it talks about even that for months he had been in, for months of futility. In Job 7:3, "I have been made to inherit months of futility, and troubled nights have assigned to me." So this is probably months later. It's long enough for word to have gotten out. We don't have Twitter. Something happens in here and there, somebody going to be tweeting it, or no, it's not Twitter anymore, it's X, or somebody going to be snapping it, somebody going to be putting it on Facebook. News is instantaneous. For them, news had gotten out. News had gotten to the surrounding areas. It had spread so much so that Job's friends got together and they said, "Hey, we should do something about this. What you think we should do?" And they would give the letter to his messenger, and the messenger would scurry to his friend's house, and they would read it and say, "Yeah, man, we do need to do something." Back goes the little messenger. And so the first guy says, "I think we should all go see him. Hey, why don't we get our other friends, and we'll go together as a group?" "Sounds good. What time works for you?" And I mean, you know how it is, the snail mail. This is probably, and it seems to be months have gone by at this point. But they get a plan together that say, "Look, I know what we need to do. We need to go to him." Now, how involved their plan was, whether they were going to come bringing relief, whether they were just going to be that calming presence, whether they were going to, take up donations and bring it to help build him back, we're not sure exactly what the plan is, but we know that his friends came when they heard of the adversity, and they each came from his house, and they met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. Let me just pause right here to say, you need Christian friends. You need Christian friends. I'm glad that you are here in this big sanctuary today. You need friends that you talk to in a much smaller room. You need Christians to be there. We talk all the time about one another and one another. And you could say that you one another when things like Job happen, but you one another before Job happens so that it's not awkward whenever it's time to one another. You encourage one another. You support one another. You challenge one another. You pray for one another. You speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. You love one another. Greet one another with a holy kiss. You do all of the one another and one another's that we talk about all the time. Because that's what Christian community is. Because God knows that when we have those, when God is good and when God seems to be our adversary, during all of those times when we see the good that God's doing and when we don't see the good that God's doing, in all those times we need Christians to speak into our lives to make sure that we're not going off track. Now these friends, they're going to give him some bad advice. In fact, the next few weeks we're going to be talking about how do we discern whether the advice people are giving us is good or not. And how do we have good Christian conversations? But right now they are coming to him and they're coming with comfort. They're coming to sympathize. And you need some people in your lives that you establish in the now so that you will have them when the time is needed. So that you can be that kind of friend. But when they looked at him from a distance, they could barely recognize him. And they wept aloud, and each man tore his robe and threw dust into the air on his head. Then they sat on the ground with him 7 days and nights, but no one spoke a word to him because they saw his suffering was very intense. They came and they sat with him for 7 days and seven nights. They came and they tore their robe and threw dust into the air and on his head. Now, whenever the only other time when dust is thrown into the air and for it to float back down is during the Exodus when Moses did it and there were boils that came on. But it's a way of identifying with him. Now, I don't know whenever they pack their clothes, I don't know if they pack their traveling clothes. And they said, when we get there, we're going to sympathize with him. So I need to bring an old T-shirt so I can Hulk Hogan rip it and so that I can sympathize with him. I don't know about the details of it, but they saw Job, this man who was now in only a loincloth, sitting in the dung heap ashes in a way of mourning. And they came and they did the same thing. And then they just sat there for a full week. Now, over the course of this period of time, that's a whole lot of mourning. That's a whole lot of weeping. I mean, nobody died, did they? I mean, Job's children died, but what they were doing looked a whole lot like what a funeral mourning would look like. And in the Hebrew thought, a lot of times they saw life and death connected, and the ideas floated around several different places where life and death are so connected that it seems as though there is that absence of life. There is that absence of breath. There is that absence of light, that absence of heat, that absence that is there. Because Job's life, where it was once filled with family, is now absent of that. That was once filled with possessions is now absent of that. That was once filled with joy is now absence of that. And so the mourning and the brokenness, the health was now absent from Job. All of it was absent from him. And it was as if he was a dead man walking or a dead man sitting. And so in the midst of the absence of all the good, they came and they were broken with him. And they came and they sympathized with him. And it's good that they did that. And we'll get into what they said a little bit later. But I want to throw something out there that I want you to see a possible analogy of what Satan is doing and what this conflict is really about. If we rewind in our Bibles all the way back to Genesis in the very beginning, in Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth, and he said, it's good. And then he started populating it, and he got Adam and Eve, and he said, oh, it's very good. And then they put them in a garden, the Garden of Eden, which is the perfect garden. They had the perfect relationship with God, the perfect relationship with each other. They had everything that their heart could desire. They were put there to till the garden, but it was not by the sweat of their brow. They had only to reach out and take what was there. It was paradise on earth, quite literally paradise on earth. And in the midst of that, they praised God and they walked with God until they were confronted with Satan, who said, did God really say, doesn't this fruit look good? You could be like God. And they reached out and they took the fruit and they ate it. And so now in their broken condition, God said, oh, no longer. No longer, your children are going to come with pain, physical pain. And no longer are you going to eat because it's just simply there. By the sweat and the toil of your brow is how you are going to eat now. No longer are you going to have that perfect relationship with God where he comes and walks with you in the cool of the day. No longer are relationships going to be good. In fact, your two oldest boys, one's going to kill the other one. No longer are things going to be good anymore. And so while they had that relationship with God to worship God in the Garden of Eden when things were perfect, what was going to happen outside the Garden of Eden when things were not perfect? And things were going in a bad way until Seth came along, and then people began to call on the name of the Lord. Similarly speaking, maybe you can see some of the parallels that are there. Job had it all. He was walking. He had the relationship with God. He had the relationship with the family. He had the relationship where everything seemed like it was given to him. And he worshiped and praised God there. But then Satan charged God and said, hey, look, but reach out and touch him. And so after reaching out and touch him, he's going to be asked with another question. What happens outside the Garden of Eden? Are you going to worship him then? Oh, sure, you worshiped him when you had all the sheep and the camels and the donkeys. Sure, you worshiped him whenever your land was being planted and harvested and everything was going good. Sure, you worshiped him whenever you had 10 kids, 7 sons and 3 daughters and everything was good. But without all of that, without even your health, whenever it's hard to, it's worse than a mosquito flying around. It's worse than a fly. In the midst of all that, out of the Garden of Eden, what are you going to do then when your life is broken, when there seems to be a complete absence of God, when there seems to be nothing? What are you going to do then? And Job said, well, I'm going to accept the good and the adversity. My answer has not changed. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in reality, that is the question that's asked us today. You might not have ever had a Garden of Eden type life. You might have always known life outside the garden. In fact, in some ways I know that is true of you because you have never had a time where you've had unbroken fellowship with God because we were born into sin and we lived in sin. We were born with that broken relationship with God. And we were born without things being perfect. We were born with things that were always bent against us. But in the midst of that, are you going to choose to worship God? Whenever you have days when you can see God's blessings, whenever somebody says, how are you doing? And you say, man, there ain't never been a day. Whenever your answer is blessed, and you could sit for hours and hours talk about how you're blessed. But in those other days, whenever you say, if you want to sit down and talk about it, I'm afraid I would run you off with all the junk that's been going on in my life. Will you praise him then? Because the same God is the same God. He is the God yesterday, today, and forever. The same God is the same God. And the reality of it is that sometimes, just as God made, whenever he created the heavens and the earth, he created the heavens and the earth, and he created the days and the nights. And the days serve a purpose, the nights serve a purpose. So also our heartache is going to bring us to a place where we see him better, where we understand him better. Our heartache, regardless of, we don't understand. Job certainly doesn't understand why this is going on or what the outcome of this is going to be. Yet even then, God can create good even out of what is broken and fallen. If God can take the world that he created and it was so good, and man can mess it up so bad that we lost Eden, we lost paradise, we lost that relationship with God, so that now the world is living under a curse instead of living under a blessing. If he can redeem the world out of that cycle of not prosperity and piety, but instead the world that was created and we broke it and we fell apart in it, if he can redeem us and he can repair that, then he can do anything. And he loves us so much that he sent his son to die for us. Jesus came to be the curse. Jesus came to be cursed on our behalf. Jesus came to carry the weight that we could not carry. He came to carry our sins to the cross. And through his dying on the cross, we can be saved. We can have our sins forgiven. We can be restored to that relationship with God. We can be restored one day to that second Eden, that paradise that is the heavenly paradise that will be unassailable, that will be great. But it's not just a that's coming in the future. It restores us to the relationship now, where we know that he walks with us, where we know that in the midst of the garden, there are so many songs. He walks with us and he talks with us and he tells me I'm his own. I come to the garden alone. He's the God that all the songs that we sing, oh, how I wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. And in the midst of all of that, we can have that blessed assurance. And all of the times where we realize of life's goods and God's bads, it's not just the goods, it's not just the bads, it's not just any particular time. He is the God of all time. And in all situations, no matter how bright your life is feeling or how dark it might seem, no matter how much you are experiencing the hand of God and you know what it is he's doing, or if you don't know what he's doing, God is always the God who is up to good. The God who is always, that is always working in our lives. Sometimes it might seem like God has put us on pause or that God has stalled out. But how many times have you, whenever you're driving, do any of you drive your cars like you drive a go-kart? It only has a gas. I don't know why they put that brake there. No, that brake is there because that brake keeps us out of situations that we don't need to be in. And sometimes what God is doing by not pushing the gas down all the time, by what seems to be pumping the brakes, is really just his goodness in keeping us away from something that we don't need to be in. And so I don't know what's going on in your life. If I ask you, how are you doing today? I don't know what you would tell me. And if we sat down for 5 hours, I don't know if I would still, or sat down for a week, I don't know exactly where it would be. But I know a couple of things. One, if you're not going through a bad time today, you will sometime. You need to be with Christian friends in a close relationship. I say Christian friends because, as we're going to talk about in a few weeks, you better be getting some good godly counsel. But I also know that it doesn't matter if today is your best day or your worst day, your highest day or your lowest day. I know that God is still with you and God has not forgotten you and that God is working. And I ask you this morning, trust in him. If you've never trusted in him for salvation, then do that. But even if you are a Christian, keep trusting in him. Don't say, God, how's my today? What's this week going to look like? Say, God, how can I follow you through whatever paths this week may hold? Whether I'm in the penthouse or whether I'm in the poop pile, help me to praise you. Help me to praise you, God, for I know that you are alive and you are working. Let's pray.